Welcome to Season 3 of Product Ops Podcast, or POP as I like to call it, with me, Jerisha Nadaraju. This season, I'm doing something different. While Season 1 focused on individual journeys into Product Ops, and Season 2 focused on how well-known tech companies scaled Product Ops, this season is all about listening to our customers. Instead of talking to people in Product Ops roles, I'll be chatting to many of the internal customers we serve, such as product managers, engineers, designers, and CPOs. There are currently a lot of people contributing to the discussion on Product Ops, which is fantastic, but it also made me curious to take a step back and look at the problem statements and the reason why this function might exist in the first place. I hope you enjoy taking time to listen to the on-the-ground reality and product challenges our customers face. This season of POP is sponsored by Beetroot. Beetroot uses AI to automatically extract key insights from customer calls to share with your entire product team. Built by alums from Google, Apple, and Palantir, it's the best way to make sure your team is working towards your customers' needs. Apply for the Beetroot private beta at btrt.io. Today's episode is a very special bonus one for Season 3. We chat to Melissa Perry and Denise Tills about their highly anticipated and newly launched Product Ops book. Melissa is the CEO of Products Labs, a product management training organization, and the author of Escaping the Build Trap. Denise has over a decade of product leadership experience and works as an independent product consultant and coach. In this episode, we find out more about their Product Ops book, the process of writing the book, and get their thoughts on the top product challenges organizations face. Listen in for some unique insights from the authors of Product Operations, How Successful Organizations Ensure Winning Strategies and Effectively Scale. Melissa and Denise, welcome to the Product Ops podcast. I am so excited to have you both on today to talk about your upcoming Product Ops book. How are you both doing today?
Doing good. Good. That's the question. We're like in the last throes of the book, so we're getting over the finish line.
It's been a long time coming. We're very excited today.
I can imagine. And I've been fortunate enough to get a copy of it to have a read before we do this interview. And it is really good. So I would say congratulations. And we'll obviously get into it more. But I guess your labor of love has paid off because I think it's a really good quality book. So well done.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
To get us started, it would be really interesting to find out, you know, what inspired you to write this book and what got you to the point of saying, hey, we want to write this book about Product Ops.
It was Denise's idea. I'll say that first. Denise was like, hey, do you want to do this book with me? I really think we need a Product Ops book. So I'll let Denise tell you guys how she got inspired first.
Yeah, it was like probably March of 2021. And I was like, I can't believe nobody's written this book yet. And we'd started doing the Product Ops masterclasses through Products Labs, Melissa's consultancy. And I thought, this would be amazing. This would be so great. And there's so many different personas that this book could serve. And so I just slacked her. I'm like, am I crazy? Is this nuts? And she's like, no, that is actually a great idea. And there we went. Off we went.
Yep. And I told Denise, I was like, I am not writing a book by myself again. So if you want to do this with me, I'm like, I'm on. Like, if we're going to do this together, like, let's do it. Because I agree. Like, I thought there needed to be a book. And I think it addresses so many of the common questions that we both get asked, like, every day. You know, how do I think about it? It solves like a lot of the problems, right? It's people ask us, how do I think about structuring my product organization? Like, how do they work better with sales? How can we work better? Get better customer research? How can sales and products start working better together? How do I get the data I need to make strategic decisions? How do I set up my process and governance and actually like review annual strategy and so much more? So I think, you know, for me, I always felt like my books were a little selfish because I was like, I'm tired of telling people how to do this 18,000 times over and over again on one-off calls. You know, here's a book, go read it. And then let's chat about like how it applies to you. So I don't have to explain the same thing over and over again. But I think that that was a big reason we wanted to do it, was just help people fill in some of those questions and be able to tackle some of these problems without having to like call us every single time.
Yeah, I think it's a really, I guess, effective way of scaling knowledge and definitely thinking like product people in terms of doing that. And you sort of touched on it, Denise, but I guess, I mean, one of the ways I found out about Products Labs, Melissa and Denise, is I interviewed someone in season one of Product Ops podcast, Sharman. She mentioned that the Product Ops function there had been set up off the back of, I think, Products Labs coming in and sort of consulting and telling them about Product Ops. So what's really cool about this is you were able to build on what you were already doing with companies and now package this into something for people.
Yeah, Denise and I have done a lot of consulting around product ops. And when we started working together in, what was it, like 2018, 2019? Yeah, 2018.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, we'd been implementing product ops since then. We've done it for dozens and dozens of companies. We've advised on it. Denise led a team at Products Labs that like went in and did it, stood it up, hired the right people, and made sure they keep going with it. So we took everything we learned through doing that and tried to turn it into this book.
I think that was kind of an advantage that we uniquely had too, because we spoke to so many practitioners, and we'll talk about the folks that we interviewed and used as case studies. But the fact that we had gone in and worked with so many different companies, you start seeing the patterns and the anti-patterns. And I think that really gave us a unique perspective to be able to share that more widely versus someone that might have done this once, twice, or three times, which is amazing and a very valuable perspective. But I think we had that scale perspective, which is helpful.
Yeah, that's great. And as I mentioned, I've been fortunate enough to read the book in advance, but could you share, I guess, for our listeners and tell them a bit more about what to expect in the book?
It was, Melissa and I talked about it and we're like, what do we want this to be? And having read so many different product books, what I loved about Escaping the Build Trap is that it was actionable, but I've read so many of them that are not and that are theoretical. It made me bananas. And I would be on Slack, you know, communities, and people were like, this is great. And X author said it should be done this way, but in reality. And I wanted to make sure we had something that was truly grounded in reality and had just so much actionable insights, positive case studies with lessons learned. And so I think that was sort of our guiding light, our, you know, product principles, if in a sense, you know, something that's actionable, really, you know, valuable for our customer, the reader, and then realistic, celebrating the wins, but also, you know, highlighting and shining a light on the challenges and lessons learned, and hopefully helping people reading the book see ahead to those corners. So that was, I think, really key.
Yeah. And I'd say, like, from the content perspective of what you can expect with that is we really looked at if you were going to stand up a product operations function, or if you even had one, what have we seen run the full gamut of it? So we go pretty extensively when we think about a fully operating product operations function. So we're not just talking about like one little piece of it. We're actually talking about how you could build one for a large organization. And we know that everybody's not going to start, you know, from the whole thing, from the whole picture, but at least gives you a vision of what it could become one day. And that's what we wanted to set up. So we talk about, you know, what is product operations and what is it not? Because there's lots of misconceptions in there. Why do you need one? And how you can tell this story too, as well, to your boss or to other people in the organization. So we really wanted to help with that. And then we break down like what we call the three pillars of product operations. So we get into our three pillars are data and insights. So how do you aggregate and be able to look at your own data and insights inside the organization and put them in the hands of people making decisions, which is both leadership and product managers and other people in the organization. So how do you get that out of systems and be able to look at it in the right way? And what data should you be looking at? Two is customer and market insights. So how do you streamline that and make sure that all the valuable customer and market insights that you're collecting around the organization make its way back to the right people? And then how do you streamline things like user research and make sure it's being done well and valuably? And then the last piece is really more about like product operating models, which is a big thing that we get asked questions about, especially from organizations standing up product organizations from scratch or people going through transformations. And it's about looking at that process and governance piece of how should the product teams be operating and like what things should we standardize and what things should we not standardize? How do you think about tools that you're going to implement? How do you think about working relationships across, you know, cross-functionally, across departments? How do you do strategy cadences and roadmaps and things like that? So that you can really think about what is it that you need to actually do product management on a cadence that's, you know, both weekly, monthly, quarterly, and yearly. So that was our last piece. And then we give tons of advice at the end for standing up a team. What does a good team look like? How do you introduce it? How do you scale it? And how should you think about your roadmap to actually implementing that?
Yeah, I thought that I love the structure of the book, by the way. And I don't know if I can I don't think this is giving anything away, but I think the thing that I particularly liked about the book was you started it off with this very, you have a worked example that goes through, it starts at the beginning and you carry this example of this sort of these people and a CPO, CEO, and sort of a real problem that this company had, and you work it throughout the book. And that opening problem, like, I think it hit a little bit too close to home. So when I read it, I was like, oh my goodness, this is exactly the problem that I've seen before, you know, where executives are trying to find information and has to do the product roadmap. They're suddenly looking, well, where do we find this? There's this disconnect between product managers. And oftentimes it honestly does start from there. And that's where you sort of need people to solve this and start digging deeper and going more. So I love that. I also love the fact that I don't know if this was intentional or not, but you had like two people in the book called like Ashley and Sunita, and they were the CEO and CPO. And it was really nice to have, I think, women's names used as the leaders in a product book. I loved that. So thanks for doing that.
These are people we know in real life in different jobs. And we see them as like future rock stars. So yeah, it was
very
important.
Very cool. And I think one thing that was interesting also with your three pillar definition is I'd actually come across it before, I think, Melissa. So like when I first started product ops, I think I latched onto this, there was an ebook called The Rise of Product Operations. And it was like in late 2019, or early 2020, there wasn't a lot of stuff in product ops. And I think you mentioned maybe these types of pillars, or I'd seen it reflected again in your work. And I almost didn't identify with it at that stage, because my slice of product ops was so like, it was also zoomed in, right? Because it's to do with your company. And then I did it again at another company that was slightly bigger. And now when I read the book, after having those two experiences, I was like, oh yes, okay, actually, I really understand now why you've specifically got a bucket that says like business data and insights, which to me at first didn't seem, because I was probably more on like the process and governance side with roadmaps and quarterly planning. And it was so hard to see that. And then you had the other one that had to do with customer and market insights. And I worked within a company where there was product analytics and there was also a user research function. And one of the problems I was trying to like help solve with them is how do we consolidate all of these different touch points of customer data, and working with these two teams that reported into different areas of the business. So they weren't all under product. And after reading this, I kind of realized that, oh, this is the future operating model in a way that could have been used to like set this up. So I think for me, like one key takeaway was you are showing almost in a way like an ideal state, or the big picture that this could become, which I think is hard sometimes for someone when you're doing like your first product ops job, or you're just focusing on a few of the pillars.
Yeah, I think that was like extremely deliberate. And when you read the book, you'll see too, Denise and I say like over and over again, you don't have to do everything at once, right? And it's because no company starts it everywhere at once. Yeah. And what we have seen over time is that everybody will call it product ops, but it's just like you said, like in one company, where they focused first was data and insights, because that's what they needed first. Like their chief product officer sometimes came in new, didn't know what was going on, didn't have the data they needed to actually make strategy decisions. And they said, I need this first, right? In a lot of larger companies, we actually see them start with that process and governance like you did, because they don't have roadmaps that they can actually reconcile against each other and communicate to the company. And also, again, the product leaders and the product managers and the CEO and everybody have no idea what everybody's doing and how it bubbles up. So I actually like worked for a CEO once, and that was our issue. And that's how I got started with product ops. And we had 5,000 people in the company, developers, 350 product teams. And there was no like combined roadmaps where we could actually see things, and information wasn't getting bubbled up to the C-suite in a way where they can make decisions. So I had a CEO of 5,000 people in an $8 billion company trying to go through Jira and read tickets. And I was like, get out of Jira. But what do we need? Like, we need to actually do something so that you can get the information you need. So that's where we started specifically with those roadmaps piece. And then it branched on and it got into the customer and market insights piece. And then it got back to the data piece. So I've seen it grow, but not every company is doing all of it at once. And that's okay. But we want you to really look at the book and say, okay, here's the gamut of what it can span. And then we try to give you some helpful tools on where you should start, depending on what your biggest need is.
Yeah. And the other thing, you've touched on it also, but it really is a very practical book, and you give guiding questions. And I think also, so I've been a product ops leader twice before. And I think as a leader, even though it is for other people, I found it really helpful, you know, where you start talking about setting up your teams and, or, you know, if you're scaling it and what you do, because it almost helps guide you into thinking, you know, number one, how do you make the case, which is something I've done before. But the next thing after making the case is you start doing the work, and you actually have to think about what your vision for this team is, right? Because you need to be a bit proactive and think about your resourcing and not just get stuck in doing, but also as a leader, put forward what you think you should be focusing on and how you should do that. And I found the examples that you gave really good in terms of thinking. And I think maybe Blake Samick also put forward his thinking and how he mapped that out there. And I wish I'd read that, like, when I was doing it.
It's true. And I think a big piece of it is that visionary you're doing. It's very practical, but even as, especially as a team of one, what's above the line, as he says, Blake, and what's below the line, and thinking about, you know, here are the capabilities today, but look what we could have. And so it's being that visionary, almost a salesperson in a way, and painting that picture. And Shintaro Matsui at Amplitude also spoke about this as well. So it's really about current state and making sure people understand the value of what the future state could be.
I mean, I'm assuming this book has already spoken to me, so I guess I put myself in your target audience, but who do you envision reading this book and getting value from it?
I think it's product managers for sure, CPOs. I also think it's CEOs, because another reason I wanted to write this book was we'd have folks coming to us, Melissa and I, and asking about, when do I do it? How do I do it? And like, I can't get my CEO on board. I wish they could take your class. And I actually did have a few folks join the masterclass, but it's like a 4-hour workshop. And we really get into, you know, a lot of, you know, nitty gritty stuff. But I thought this would be a great thing to hand your CEO. A, this is a function, this is a discipline, and they can sort of dip into it. And even your product folk, your person could say, hey, make sure you check out page 64. This is really speaking to where our challenges are. So I think it really has a number of target readers. What do you think, Melissa? Anybody else?
Yeah. I'd say too, like in large companies, I work with a lot of like companies doing transformations. There's usually people who are in charge of the transformation.
Yeah.
And they're going, where do I start? And typically what happens is you go and you train all your product managers, and then you got to actually build the organization, right? So then we start talking about what are roles and responsibilities. And I felt like that's something I really concentrated on in Escaping the Build Trap, was like making sure that people understood the role of a product manager and how that career path actually operates. This is now like, what do we do for the rest of the organization to help make those product managers successful? And I think people who are leading those transformations, even if they're not, sometimes they're not a chief product officer there. There's somebody who works for the chief product officer, sometimes a chief of staff or someone who is in charge of like setting up. They're setting up all these things. They just don't know their product operations yet. Let's put it that way. But they're trying to figure out like, how do I do roadmaps? How do I like, what else do I need to actually make this organization successful? I think that hits home a lot for them too.
Yeah, I'm definitely seeing, I wouldn't say a trend, but I mean, a lot of companies are now saying, you know, they want to be product-led. They want to be product-led. And but not from just the product team saying this, but the actual founders, CEOs also now saying, we want to be a product-led org, and making sure that all the other functions like sales and whoever are on board with this and doing that transformation. And so, yeah, I think that's definitely helpful.
Yeah. And I think like product-led gets taken out of turn sometimes, where people don't quite understand what that means. So I feel like I'm always doing this myth. And to me, what product-led actually means is that the product is leading, like we lead our strategy by the product, not just by going out there and hammering sales home on everybody and selling to everybody, right? And forcing it down their throats. It's more like the product is so valuable, it's doing what people want it to do. So they're coming to us, right? And that's the goal of having product led. And we're looking at our strategy, and we're thinking about the strategy of our company from a perspective of how do we grow that product, and how do we grow through selling products instead of selling unrepeatable services or things that don't make sense, right? Like we're trying to scale in a sustainable way through the products that we sell. And a lot of that has to do with software these days, but a lot of organizations are just getting used to that, right? They did not actually operate that way. They operated through sales and they operated through marketing. So a lot of the processes and a lot of the ways that they've been set up are to enable sales or to enable marketing, but it's not to enable product. And that's what this book helps with as well. It's showing you that if you do want to be product led, these are all the other pieces that you need. And they're very, very different than what you didn't need when you were growing through sales or when you were growing through marketing or you were growing through services. It's a completely different operating model for a business. And if you're not arming people with the data that they need to set that type of product strategy or the, you know, the feedback loops to make sure it's on the right track or the tools that they need to be able to make strategic decisions, you're going to find yourself in trouble. And that's what we're really trying to solve here.
Well, changing tracks a bit, I am so interested in the process, the book writing process. Denise, I guess, what did you learn when writing this book that surprised you?
Oh, gosh, I guess it was a pleasant surprise in that where product operations is really like taken hold and showing and demonstrating value, that the leadership in the companies, they were seeing it and giving these teams more responsibility and bringing more teams underneath these leaders. Specifically, I'm thinking about Claire Hawthorne at Oscar Health. Her team has grown because she's just this dynamo who is, you know, driven and shown all sorts of value in terms of like getting their arms around annual planning in a sort of responsive and thorough way. Annabella Cesario at OutSystems, who was leading product ops and then took her boss's job as VP of product. And now she has a head of product ops reporting to her. So it was great to see how these things are maturing. These roles are maturing and growing. So that was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, I season two of Product Ops podcast was all about how, I guess, well-known companies scale product ops. So we also had like Blake and his team and Christine and other people who are actually mentioned in your book, which is great to see guests.
Christine Waru, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think the other thing, I mean, I guess the flip side of that, Denise, I don't know if that came through too, is that for some people though, they can still be spending a lot of time actually trying to make the case for product ops. And what I love about this book, and I think because it's here and the two of you have written it and you've worked in product and you have a lot of understanding of this, is the I feel like people in their team, this is going to speed up the process of adoption of product ops, because you have created this wonderful asset that if somebody is trying to get it over the line or explain the value, they can almost tell their CPO or whoever it is, read this book, and you know, or they can pull on it. So I feel like you've sort of helped with that too, which some people can sometimes find is that it's hard to make the case.
Yes. And we talk about this in the book. You know, we still hear stories about product managers doing all sorts of things that you would not necessarily expect them to be doing, you know, product marketing, which is, you know, we expect product manager to be doing some of that, but doing all of it, no product marketing function, research off the side of their desk. And they're burning out. And, you know, we're here, some CEOs like, this is their job. Product managers, these are their jobs. And what we hope product operations and have seen it work in this way is, you know, helping the product managers focus on their key strengths and what they were hired for, right? Delivering strategy to, you know, create business value.
And Melissa, you also touched on this right at the start that you didn't want to write a book by yourself again. But I did want to know, you know, what was it like co-writing a book with someone, given that you already have Escape the Build Trap that is out there and hugely popular, and you did that as a solo author?
So much better. It was like, I probably would have taken another like 5 years to finish this if it wasn't for Denise. I think it's nice to co-write with people. You know, there's pros and cons to everything, but the pros completely outweigh the cons in this case, because we could brainstorm stuff together. We were like, how do we actually explain this in a way other people were going to do? And if it was just me by myself, I'd be like bugging other people to come help me that have no skin in the game. But, you know, we had a partner to actually do stuff with. And my biggest hurdle whenever it comes to writing, and same for Escaping the Build Trap, was like literally just getting things on paper. And having an accountability partner was great for that, because we'd be like, did you do your work? And there'd be weeks where I know we have like Friday calls. There'd be weeks we'd sit there and be like, did you do anything? Nope. Did you do anything? Nope. And we're just like so over it in the middle of it. But then we kind of powered through and set ourselves a deadline and got through. But I always felt like I can't disappoint Denise, so I got to get my work done.
Same.
Which was a great like motivating factor for that. So I really enjoyed that piece. And I think we both brought some really good different skills to it. Like I knew how to write a book now, and that made this 10 times easier than writing Escaping the Build Trap. Like I had never written anything before. So I was like, how do you structure a book? What makes a chapter? What doesn't make a chapter? And you don't really get any help with that. And a lot of people think like editors help you with that, or like, you know, the publisher will help you. They don't. They're just like, go write me a book. So this time it was really nice, because I was like, all right, here's what we have to do. This is how we start. This is how we structure it. This is what we need to do. And that just sped up the process a lot at the beginning, so that we could dive in and just focus on the content. And I'm so happy too that we got case studies, and Denise did a ton of the legwork getting like all those case studies together and getting the approvals. And we were like really down to the wire with our last approval for the case study, but we got it. And I'm so happy, because that makes it was such a good experience too, because I feel like the companies that shared their case study here were so willing and open to do that. And when it came to escaping the bill trap, the reason I wrote like the fictitious story through it, and like we have a fictitious story, but supported by case studies, was that so many companies are not willing to talk about the struggles, right, that they're actually finding in the challenges. And that's what makes it hard to write a book about how you set up things and turn it around, right? They don't want to tell those turnaround stories. And when I wrote Escaping the Bill Trap, there wasn't a lot of turnaround stories to even tell at the time. Now I think there's a lot more successes out there, which has been great. But it was very hard for me to go find companies that were willing to put their names in a case study about struggling or not doing something correct. And this time it was so much better, because we were like, we want to celebrate you. Come tell everybody how you're doing this well. And they were still willing to talk about challenges and setting it up. So there's so much more openness, I think, now than in I started writing Escaping the Bill Trap in like 2015, 2016, than it was back then, to talk about how we overcome challenges, how we do that. And I'm really grateful for the companies, and for Denise going out there and like, you know, finding all these companies as well. And some that we worked with, some that we didn't work with, that really helped bring this to life.
And I think it really helps make the book have a sense of like, you know, that on the ground reality, where sometimes, you know, the theoretical books, like you said at the beginning, it can be quite disconnected with the fires and things that people are actually dealing with, you know, at companies. So yeah, it is really great that you were able to get those stories and people shared it, because it helped bridge that gap, I think, between theory and reality. I also can say, I haven't written a book, but I have started another podcast, but I've done it with a friend this time, and a former colleague. And it is so much better having a co-host and somebody to like halve the editing, halve the like everything that goes along with it. So I can only imagine that, and also we're accountable to each other. So sometimes when I don't feel like doing it, I feel bad if I don't do it because of her. And so we've sort of pushed through and almost finished with that season. Well, on season 3 of Product Ops Podcast that we've just sort of coming to the end of, and we're going to end off with this episode and have you guys as a bonus, I was actually listening to our internal customers. So I wasn't speaking to people in Product Ops roles. I was talking to people such as product managers, CPOs, engineers, product designers. And I was asking them, you know, what do you think are the top challenges in how we do product currently? And kind of taking a step back and looking at problem statements and then seeing, you know, where is that something that Product Ops is looking at, or what can we be doing? I would be so curious to find out from each of you, what do you think, given your experience and knowledge and working with people, is like the top challenge at the moment in how we do product?
Where do we start? I'd say if we take them one by one, right, with the pillars with business data and insights, is a surprising lack of foundational implementation. Some companies don't even have the hooks in for event tags, or they have a system set up that's so sprawling. One company we worked with had it's a SaaS product, had like 70 different features. They didn't charge any more money for it. They thought it was just adding more value, but they couldn't tell you the engagement and usage of each one. So they had no sense of prioritization when there were problems or people wanted requests. So things that you would assume are pretty foundational are not necessarily set. Not everywhere, but definitely more than I expected.
Yeah, I think that's like a top one that Denise is talking about. And that's like something that we faced when we were consulting. So a lot of times we'd go in to an organization and it would be like, we were working with a venture capitalist with Insight Partners at this time. And we were trying to help a new chief product officer who had just stepped in the door and said, I want to get the lay of the land so that I can set the product strategy, figure out what's going on. And we'd have a team that could go in and pull the data for them. But then there so many times there'd be no data to pull. So we had to say, you know, you need to go instrument all this stuff so that we can pull this, like, we'll see you in 3 to 4 months so that we have enough data to actually analyze. And that was so hard. And it prevents, I think, these very talented, very expensive leaders from being able to do their job immediately. And the, you know, CEO will look at the chief product officer that just came in and be like, where's my strategy? It's like, how am I supposed to make a strategy based off like absolutely zero data that you have? And we could always like scrape together whatever we possibly could. And I'm not saying that you can't do that, but it makes it extremely hard to do your job and do it super well when you have nothing there. And I think people take for granted, especially as you start scaling, like how long it takes to get good data and how important it is when you're trying to make rapid strategic decisions. So I think that definitely inhibits a lot of product teams out there from being able to take their full potential. And sometimes leaders look at it and they're like, oh, my product managers aren't good. And it's like, no, you might have the most brilliant people there. They just can't do their job because you're not arming them with the things that they need to be able to make the decisions that you hired them to make.
Do you think that's a case of, because I've seen this, I've been an early employee in an early stage startup. And obviously when you're like 10 people and then you become 20 and you keep doubling and you get to about 100, you see certain problems start to now crop up as you're trying to scale and do things. But the one thing is having people who do data is often one of the last things, I think, as you're doing that. You often don't have a JD to like have a product analyst or a data person. You know, you're getting PMs, you're getting other people. But at least when I was in that startup, it took a while before we made our first data hire. Do you think it needs to be somebody who comes in to focus on it, or more could be done internally to try and sort that out?
I mean, ideally, yes, we'd have someone hired. And I was chatting with a client the other day and we were talking about mistakes, like their best mistake. And someone said, you know, the question that you have, I wonder who does X. And that typically is the question, right? Who's implementing the data tracking? Who's looking at it? And if you're asking, it's probably not happening.
I agree. Like, I think you need somebody dedicated to it. And I think a really good story of, you know, somebody I had on my podcast, Stephanie Lua from Doodle, she's the chief product officer. They started with such a data mindset. And I asked them about this. I was like, it's amazing. She was like, I love the data team at Doodle. They, you know, I can get any information that I need at my fingertips. They help surface up insights so that I can make the strategic decisions and I don't have to go like sift through a SQL database and try to find these things. And I said, how did it like get started there? And she said, the founders believed in the power of data. So they did it from day one and they never had to. And they are always thinking about how to improve it, how to get it. And I think that's so important that the leadership understands that the data is not just for the product managers, it's for them. And the most valuable thing you can do is make sure that you're equipped to lead your company, even if it's a small startup. And it's different, I know, when you have like 5 customers and you can go just watch what they're doing. But if you don't think about those things at the beginning and you don't implement it in time, now you're making $20 million a year. You've got, you know, Doodle has 32 million customers. I don't know how that's not their revenue. I'm not trying to say that, but like they've got 32 million customers. Like, how are you going to track that and try to start implementing that late in the game? Right. And I think that's what makes it powerful for them to be able to do things. So I'm watching companies scale. I watch them get to this point where they're ready to hire a chief product officer. They got 10, they got 15 product managers now. And then those people can't make decisions. And then they start to go, why? And I do think it's something you got to think about super early. And I think you have to have somebody dedicated to it and not push it off. Everybody's like, oh, there's more important things we need to be building, like revenue generating features. Yeah, that's important. I'm not saying that's not important, but you got to make time. You got to make time to make sure those revenue generating features are actually doing what they need to do.
Yeah. Denise and Melissa, did you have another one? Because obviously that touches on data and insights, and that was one of the key pillars of product ops, and it is extremely important.
Yeah. I guess the other challenge is the surfacing up of the what's happening now on the teams. And that's more from a roadmap perspective. And I know sometimes people poo-poo this of like the importance of, you know, doing roadmaps or having people like concentrated on that. And we can get into a whole tool debate on that, but it's incredibly important. And I don't think we're doing that at scale well. And it's not just the tool. It's actually like how we write the roadmaps. And, you know, when I was leading the transformation at Athena Health, that was one of our biggest issues that we're looking at. We found out that the way that the product teams were communicating up into the level of, you know, that was required for a leader to look at it, for somebody else to look at it and know what was going on, was very disparate. Like every team was writing things in different levels of detail. Some was too specific, some was too high. And I think that's a piece of it too. It's not just about getting a tool in there. And I do think you need a tool. You definitely need a tool to be able to track your portfolio and your roadmap, but you also need to take the teams and have a system for it, right? And have a structure for updating the roadmap, reviewing the roadmap, doing that on the right cadences, writing the right level of detail, and then being able to, as a leader and as teams, like know what's going on, and sharing that information is incredibly important too. So I think that's something that I don't see being done super well at a lot of companies. And one, large companies that did not have a strong product leader and are now trying to implement that struggle there. And a strong product leader will come in and ask for it, just like that was one of her stories in the book, and it won't be there. So that hurts them. But then also smaller companies that are scaling, it's different when you can turn around and just talk to people and know what's going on. But then you get to a certain level where that's not possible anymore. And you have to think about that, I think, from day one, so that you can scale up. So I do see in every stage of company struggles with it to varying degrees. And it could be either on a process level, it could be at a cadence level, it could be at a tool level, or it could be at the specificity of like our strategy. Like what does it mean to have like a company strategy, and what are the different levels and how does a roadmap relate to that?
Yeah, I've seen that. I've dealt or looked at that problem in my two previous product ops roles. And I think, like you said, I think what I'm learning, you know, it's not necessarily the you need a tool. The tool choice just depends, but you can implement it with a tool and have it there, but it might not take off and it might not be successful. Because if you haven't thought about, for example, like your flight levels, like what kind of information needs to actually be surfaced for execs, for, you know, the middle layer, for your squads and teams, and what do they need to use, and how did that all tie up and roll up? For example, mapping that out, that makes it difficult. If you have not educated people on how to use this and people don't have access to the tool and you haven't thought about all of those things, that could also make it difficult. And then the third thing I found is that you can put it out there, but if no one is making sure that the way you're using that tool is baked into the way that you're working, so your quarterly planning, your annual processes, those meetings, if like your execs are not going back to the view that you've put there, that tool and that information will die, and then it just becomes static and people don't update it. So there's different, you have to make sure you're getting it from almost every angle for that to work. And I think sometimes people underestimate how much of time that can take to tweak and iterate on and then actually get full adoption across the company.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the point.
Okay, Melissa. I was going to say, like Klaus calls them flight levels. We call them strategic levels if you're reading our book. Like that's our strategic framework. Same thing. It's about those different various layers and how they all roll up. But Denise, what were you going to say too about it?
Oh, I was going to say that actually ties in to part of the case study in the book with Shintaro Matsui at Amplitude. And you know, one of the key things that he's implemented there is a quarterly review of all these processes and tools, and has the teams rank what's the most useful, what's the least useful. And you have to sort of be, you know, monitoring this as if it is a product, but it's serving the teams and it's, you know, usefulness and the capabilities, and, you know, monitoring and seeing, you know, do we need to tweak? Do we need to deprecate it? So really you touched on it. You really have to sort of be actively working with it.
Yeah. And I don't think that's just road mapping tools. I think that's all tools as well. Even, you know, implementing a product analytics type tool, right? If you don't implement it in the correct way, or you don't empower your product managers to use it, because you're just like telling them what to build, it doesn't matter, right? If you're not incorporating into stuff, it will eventually die out.
Yeah. And like on that point, I was just thinking when I was looking at the road mapping planning tool, one of the things was that does it integrate with our product analytics tool so that we can automate? And because the hardest thing is when people have to manually type things in with this, you want to automate as much as you can. And so things like that are key. Well, those have been very helpful. And I don't actually know if the guests this season have touched on either of those. That's cool that you have brought those up. I don't know if there's one other that you want to talk to before we move on.
I guess with the second pillar of customer market insights, I think the ability to empower the product folks to be able to sort of learn how to fish and do their own research. We've talked to some great companies that have some programs in place, because user researchers is never enough, right? And if you're working at a huge company like Fidelity Investments, you know, how do we support and make sure that they're set up to succeed in terms of getting those qualitative insights? So that's an area that feels like it's growing, but there's a lot of opportunity in terms of being able to support the product team.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And one issue I keep hearing now, I got this question written into my podcast a couple of times, and at first I was like, what's going on? And now I kind of realize what's going on. There's a lot of frustration, I think, from leaders and from other people about like, there's this fight going on, right? Between product managers and leaders about how much customer research. And I think on one side, you know, you need to be talking to your customers and doing that. And the product managers are like, we need to be talking to our users. We need to be talking to our customers. So I get product managers who say they don't have time to do that, or they're not allowed to do that, and people are not you know, telling them to do that. And I'm like, what's going on here? I think we fought that battle of I need to talk to my customers. And most places understand that now, right? Most places know that product managers need to do that. On the other side, the leaders are like, oh my God, my product team has just spent the last 8 months in discovery and nothing has happened, right? All they're doing is talking to people. They're not actually acting on it. And a lot of the stuff that they're learning exists in our company. Like, we already knew those things. So there's this piece of what's the middle ground, right? And I think like when people go to teach good product management, like we do teach people about customer research and how to do it well, but there's still some misunderstandings out there. And I think this customer and market insights piece that we're trying to talk about is like, hey, there's probably a lot of things that are known to your company already. And we can collect that and unlock it from systems that it's been kept in from, like sales, for instance, right? Or from, you know, it's stuck in Salesforce, it's stuck in their minds. How do we learn what they know? And there's no shame in that. And I want product managers to understand, like, just because sales told you that a customer said this thing or had this problem doesn't mean it's not true because you didn't learn it yourself. Like, that's, we got to get over that, right? It's okay to look at it to see. And if you've heard the same thing from 18 salespeople, it's probably true that problem is there. Now your job is to figure out what are the aspects of that problem that you can solve, right? And that's where we pick up from it. So it's like, you don't have to learn everything individually yourself. That's okay. Take the data that's available to you and then ask the questions as a follow-up. What else do I need to learn? What do we need to go do? And I think that's really a struggle right now in the product management community is how do I sift through the noise, sift through all this different data and figure out what step to take next? And I see like two sides of it. One, how do we get the information unlocked from the other systems and back to the product management team? How do we also make sure that we have good user research disseminated throughout the organization? Like, I've seen people go out and do user research in an organization of, you know, thousands of people, and then somebody else repeats the same research over here, and you're just doing the same thing over and over again. So how do we share that knowledge? Because it's valuable, right? It can help us. It can speed up the process. But then also, how do we enable the product managers to go out and do that follow-up question, do those follow-up research, right? To go talk to the customer if they have to go test their prototypes if they have to. And how do we streamline that in a way where the product manager isn't spending 30 hours just trying to recruit two people to do a prototype with? And that's really one of those struggles that we hit home on in that like customer market insights piece, because I see it happen over and over again. So I think the way that we do user research, and I feel like when I started speaking at conferences like 10 years ago, I was like, please do user research. And now I'm like, yes, keep doing user research. But sometimes we do know the answer. And I need you to understand that as a product manager, is that we do know what the problem is. Maybe we don't understand everything about the problem, but it's not like we have to go out and do 8 months of validation again. We need to just confirm and move, right? We need to confirm and act. We need to take the next step to start thinking about it. And we don't have to overemphasize on those pieces. So I still see that as a fuzzy thing for teams getting used to product management or getting familiar with it today.
That's a piece of product operations too. I think in general, a lot of companies that we speak with and folks we speak with, they're, you know, tell us about your qualitative inputs and like, oh, that's handled over there. Tell us about your quantitative with your business data insights. Oh, we have an analytics team. Product operations harnesses that. Doesn't have to originate from them, but puts it in context for product.
Yeah. I mean, what you said there just resonated so much just with my own experience. And as I was saying, like, I've worked in a company that had a product analytics function that reported into one area. Mm-hmm. You had a user and customer research function that was gathering up information that reported into a different thing, and then product ops sitting under product. And I think, you know, one of the things is with product ops, you can still have those people doing those, but you almost want to bring everybody together. And because they had initiatives, they were each trying to do things to help get customer information consolidated, but it was almost overlapping and it was also ineffective because it wasn't actually getting to the people who needed it, which were like the product managers. So, you know, right information was not going to right people at the right time. And cracking that is quite difficult because customer information can be all over the place. You know, then if you think about customer support agents or core agents or on the phone with customers and all of that. So it is everywhere. But yeah, that's such a good point, Melissa. And also very topical because Sean, who episode 9 of season 3, his thing was all about like one of his challenges was about learning from the people who know. So as a product manager, being able to get the information that sales and customer success and people like that have. So yeah, that's a very good point. Thank you for those challenges. They were really good. And I think I definitely could relate to a lot of them. And having read the book, I can also now see like, you know, how you could actually start tackling some of them. through product ops, at least. I am sort of running out of time with the two of you, so I'd love to just wrap up with two final questions. I'd love to find out, you know, what is one takeaway that you'd love readers of the book to walk away with after reading it?
I think a takeaway is that it's totally doable and you don't have to boil the ocean. And you just need to figure out what the most important needs and opportunities are. And it's okay to start as a team of one. Most companies start that way.
Yeah. And I guess my biggest takeaway, I think, for people is to understand that I would like them to see a whole picture of the product organization and like what it takes to actually stand one up. Because it's not just about taking a bunch of people and calling them product managers or hiring a bunch of product managers. There's a whole infrastructure to it that needs to happen in order for those product managers to be successful. And that's really what we were trying to solve with this book. Like, I think a lot of books have written about what is a product manager and what are they supposed to do? And our book is more about, you know, instead of the process that a product manager does every day, we're trying to write the book that's how do you enable those product managers to be successful? And how do you enable that organization to be successful?
I love the fact that you mentioned the word infrastructure. I haven't actually thought of it like that before, but yes, that's exactly what it is. You need the infrastructure in order for, you know, the product organization to actually operate well. And that is really where, you know, product ops comes in to help you enable all of that. That's a great way of looking at it.
We should change the description on our book.
Again,
like, what can I go update now on the back cover?
I was just thinking, because I used to, one of the companies I worked at, it was called Trulia, and they did APIs. And so it was sort of business to business. But the whole thing with the APIs, we're doing open banking, was we were creating the infrastructure layer for this to happen. And we were serving other fintech companies. So that's who are our customers. And I'm thinking, yeah, that is it. We are like enabling, and it is creating the piping or the infrastructure to make product teams work. So yeah, I don't know if you can put that in, but that really, like, it just clicked for me when you said that, by the way.
I'm definitely going to go tweak some things after this. I like how you phrase that.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. And I guess finally, how can readers get hold of this book and find out more about the work that the two of you are doing at Products Labs, and when is the book launching? If you have a date?
It'll be out in October. For sure. And you can go to Amazon and buy through there. So that'll be the fastest way to get it into your hands. If you're a company, you want to buy books for a lot of people, you can reach out to us at melissa@productslabs.com, and I'll reroute it to the right people to get you those books. If you want to learn more about product operations, go to productoperations.com. You can learn more about the book. We'll have the links to actually buy the book there. And then Denise and I host classes on product operations. So we'll always update that with new classes and new case studies and things that are going on in the community.
Awesome. By the way, I was just going to tell you, I spoke to a product ops team at a company called Fair, just at their team offsite on Wednesday. And I told them about this book that was coming. And they got so excited about it, because also they wanted to start a product ops team book club. And so your book is actually going to be, you know, the first book that they start off with as their team book club pick. So yeah, cool. You've got a lot of people that are waiting for this. Yeah.
Yeah. We've been waiting for it too. So we're very happy that it's done.
Well, you know, Melissa, Denise, thank you so much. Thank you for putting this wonderful book together that I think is going to help a lot of people who are working in product op. I've read it. I really think it's helpful. I was like, I wish I had this when I was doing other roles, and I will definitely carry it through into whatever I do going forward. It was also lovely to see guests from Product Ops podcast featured in the book, which was really cool, and some awesome case studies. So yeah, thank you very much.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for the promotion. Yeah. And thanks for having us.
And that's it for season 3 of Product Ops Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed listening. And if you'd like to be a guest on season 4 next year, please get in touch and subscribe at productopspod.com. That's productopspod.com. Thanks, and take care.